This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
There's absolutely no interest, at least from an economic standpoint, in further developing strong renewable sources when oil is $45 a barrel.
Some energy analysts predict that the past year's downward trend in oil prices will continue. Our guest this week on Sea Change Radio, energy expert Dan Dicker, disagrees. He thinks that the price of oil will inevitably rise again, and sooner than many of his colleagues believe. Dicker comes on this week to explain his prediction and why he thinks a little more pain at the pump might, in the long run, be a good thing. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Dan Dicker. He is an energy expert, and his latest book is Shale Boom, Shale Bust, The Myth of Saudi America. Dan, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. Always great to talk to you.
So since we spoke last year, why don't you catch us up first on where oil prices have gone? They were starting to really descend into the $50, $60 a barrel range, and we were throwing out all the different reasons. Was it Saudi Arabia deciding not to play along with what the rest of OPEC was doing? Was it the fracking revolution here in the U.S.? Now that we have 10 months since our last discussion or so, give us a little bit more perspective if you can.
Yeah, all of the above and more. I mean, the book is not only an analysis of the bust in oil prices and what caused it, but also, I hope, something of a predictor of the future and how, in a lot of ways, these busts bring together opportunities, both in the renewable space as well as in the traditional oil space. So, sure, there's been all of that. There was the Saudis. There's been the huge increase in production here in the United States. There's been increased production in other places as well. There's been a dollar run caused by a lot of other economies who have tried to devalue their currency. So strong dollar equates to a lower oil price. That's helped. There's been a change in the way that the financial world does business with oil, and a lot of the speculative drive that came from the investment banks. In a lot of ways, Dodd-Frank kind of exposed and ran a lot of that business out. And that's helped to depress the price. So in all ways, you know, there's been sort of a perfect storm that's kind of accumulated to drive prices lower. And that's kind of where we are now. We're at this kind of nadir in prices that, and now everybody's trying to wonder, you know, how long it lasts. And some analysts believe, I don't, but there are lots of analysts who are out there saying this is the new normal, that low energy prices are going to be what we're going to see for the next several years, if not in fact, OPEC came out, doesn't believe it'll see $80 oil prices until 2020. I mean, I disagree entirely, but if you're looking for an expert, is there anybody better than OPEC? I don't know.
And it seems like some of the reasons that people are giving now for these lower prices and the speculative nature of the oil business right now and oil prices is the Chinese economy and U.S. shale production. You just wrote a piece on thestreet.com, which kind of took issue with the lead Goldman Sachs commodity analyst, Jeffrey Curry, who sees a move to $20 a barrel oil. You don't agree. Why don't you explain why?
I can't stress enough the catastrophic results that would occur with a $20 oil price for global economies, and I'm not just talking about the Russians or the Iranians or the Venezuelans, but here in the United States, a lot of the economic progress that we've made since the disaster in 2008 has been, you know, to some degree, unfortunately, due to the increase in oil revenue, jobs in the oil patch, at least a million jobs have come from the energy industry since 2008. And a lot of those are at threat right now. And at $20, nobody in the United States makes a dime. In fact, every barrel that comes out of the ground, save for, you know, very few, are losers at that price. And when you're pumping something out at a loss, it doesn't economically, it can't last very long. And that's really what's going on even now at $45. But at $20, it happens so much more rapidly. It cannot come without a depression in the global economy. That's something that I just don't believe that will happen.
So is Mr. Curry thinking that these lagging Chinese economic indicators mean that we are headed for a concomitant depression in economic growth, and that's maybe why oil would be consistent with that lagging?
I think Goldman Sachs has an obligation to its clients, which are very large commercial players, to not be optimistic and force some a bad judgment based upon an optimism. So they have to, in some ways, protect against. They don't have to protect against being right. They got to protect on not being wrong. And so yes, I think that there is a worry about a Chinese economy that's real and maybe underappreciated. I think that that's true. But for the most part, I think that Goldman Sachs cannot, for example, say we're going to get constructive on oil very quickly, because that, you know, allows a number of their clients to start investing in oil retrieval. That if those prices don't materialize, those higher prices don't materialize, bankrupts them. So their first obligation is to be conservative in their look at oil prices. And in fact, the note that Goldman Sachs made only mentioned $20 as a possible outlier type of number. They're really talking about what they believe to be a very sustained lower price of oil for a much longer time than for example, I'm looking at. That's really what they're trying to say.
That $20 is kind of just a headline grabber more than
anything. Yeah, everybody kind of makes these kind of range type predictions. Some of the things that you do when you're on air or when you're an analyst or when somebody asks you for a prediction, the toughest thing to do is say, I believe it's going here, and give it one number. Most of the major analysts give you a range of numbers that are very, very wide and really don't give you much of an indication of how they believe, you know, oil prices are going to run.
They just want to be able to point back to their employers later and say, see, I was right, or I wasn't wrong.
I wasn't wrong is the key. That's the key phrase for all of these analysts. I wasn't wrong. I don't have that limitation because I don't have clients. So I can make a prediction on exactly where I think oil is going to go and when I think it's going to go there.
So we didn't talk about the variable of the Chinese economy last time, but we did discuss the potential and the present realities of the U.S. shale industry. Where have things shifted? You said that last fall there was lots of indicators that were showing that shale production was scaling back and that the 900-pound gorillas were going to basically survive, but all these little fragmented shale producers were going to fall by the wayside because of these price drops. Has that come true yet? And do you see that still being a path?
So the surprise for me has been how nimble in terms of financial kind of tricks that a lot of these smaller players can play in order to stay alive despite being, you know, on the verge of bankruptcy.
Can you give us an example?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, Halcon did something a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, which was just outrageous in terms of, but it will keep them alive. What they did is that they restructured their bonds. So some of their debt, they went to some of their bondholders and they said to them, look, you know, we're going to go broke unless, of course, you decide to take 30 cents on the dollar on the bonds that you hold right now. Now, they're going to face a whole rash of lawsuits by pulling this fandango on other bondholders and common stockholders. you know, without their permission or without asking anybody at all, just doing it unilaterally. But again, that's something that I guess they'll worry about down the road. Survival is the first thing that they worry about. And this, in fact, allows them to survive for a little bit longer. So these kinds of restructurings and, in fact, some sort of the type of refinancings that they have been able to accomplish. Again, you know, it's that old saying, you know, if you owe the bank $1,000, the bank owns you. And if you owe the bank $1 million, you own the bank. And it's one of those things where, you know, a lot of these companies have come to the banks and say, look, you can either extend our credit or increase our revolver lines or, you know, just shut us down and take all the assets. Well, banks are not oil companies and they don't want assets, you know, and in some ways they're in the prayer game with the oil companies having put out all of this capital to keep these guys alive. And they want to wait around and see if oil prices will recover. And in fact, their investments will recover with them.
And what price do you see oil needing to be at in order for this shale boom to make its recovery? Or are we past that point?
No, not at all past that point. I mean, this is the prices are incredibly unsustainable here. And all that happens when oil companies, or at least the smallest ones, when they restructure or refinance, all they do is continue to be able to run out of clock. But there is, you know, they're still going broke. They're just going broke more slowly. I mean, that's what's been the way that I've witnessed it is been the interesting part or the fascinating part is how much money continues to chase companies that are absolutely unsustainable, are on a path to zero, can't avoid that path to zero unless oil, for example, would recover above $85 or $90 within the next 6 months, which is not going to happen. So, you know, there's been a sort of a group kind of a fantasy that's been going on inside the industry for the last 6 or 7 months, and looks like it's going to go on for as long as they can continue to put the laughing gas into the mask.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to energy expert Daniel Dicker. Dan's latest book is Shale Boom, Shale Bust, The Myth of Saudi America. So Dan, when you talk about prices not going back up to $85, $90 a barrel anytime soon, oil prices, that is. Why is that? Because we did see a real sudden drop from the 120s to where we are now over a 6 to 12 month period. Are the fundamentals just not in place for this?
Well, first of all, let me say that I not only expect prices to go up eventually, I expect them to make a new high, a historic high. Because what happens with some of these failures or these bust cycles is that they do ultimately take a whole lot of production offline. And if you don't get a concurrent drop on the demand side, which by all indications you haven't gotten, at some point down the line you run into a supply squeeze and a shortage. And that is something that I predict will happen on a lot sooner than, for example, OPEC or Goldman Sachs believes will happen. But the reason it won't happen immediately, and it doesn't happen immediately, is because there are market conditions that need to clear. So it's not enough for someone to say, I know that production is going to come offline in the next year and a half. You have to see some of that actually start to come out of the supply chain. And for right now, although there are some small indications that some supply is coming offline, it's coming off very, very slowly. Again, these energy companies are looking to stay alive for as long as they can, and that means pump for as long as they can. And there comes a point where you hit this wall where there are players that just can't take it anymore, and that's when you'll get real drops in production potential, not only from U.S. shale players, But, you know, we see signs of that happening in Canadian crude production. I see a sign of that happening for sure in offshore crude production. Leases, for example, in the Gulf of Mexico are at 30-year lows. I mean, that there's no money going in, for example, in Mexico, despite the fact that they've recently tried to open their oil for foreign investment. Brazil has tremendous problems. The Venezuelans clearly have no money left and horrible credit. The Iraqis equally are having difficulty finding the capex to expand production. All of these things point to a supply problem down the road, but for right now and for the foreseeable future, we're still operating under 1.5 million barrel a day surplus, surpluses here in the United States that are at historic highs compared to five-year averages.
And what do you mean by Saudi America? Why don't you explain that part of your thesis?
Well, the idea of Saudi America, and you heard it for several years as the boom was going on, was that this country was going to become not only energy independent, but it was going to be able to use its energy sources sort of as a sledgehammer in global relations in much the same way that we use our military forces as a sledgehammer in global relations, and that oil would become another economic sort of beast to control the global economies and keep the United States as you know, the preeminent nation on the planet. Now, that hasn't happened, and all of those ideas of energy independence haven't happened. And part of what I try to describe in the book is how United States oil and gas is different from what's going on in the rest of the world and why that hasn't happened. Because this was something, you know, that a lot of politicians kind of crowed about in Washington and the power that would come from energy independence in oil and gas. And quite frankly, it doesn't happen, it can't happen, and it won't ever happen.
And one of the things that you are fond of setting forth for your viewers on TV and readers is that energy is pretty much the source of all this economic discussion that we have. It all connects back to energy. But why don't we delve into the complexity from an environmentalist standpoint? Somebody who's a listener of Sea Change Radio, I would assume, cares deeply about the environment. When we hear about these low oil prices, on one hand, it sounds great that perhaps the Alberta tar sands production is going to be cut back. And anybody who's followed that has heard the quotes from James Hansen saying, if we excavate all the oil in Alberta tar sands, it's game over for the environment. But then on the other hand, when we see these low oil prices, that means people stop being conscious of in the transportation sector and they'll buy a big car and they'll use as much gas as they want if it's cheap. Right now we're seeing oil prices, we're seeing gas prices pretty low here in this country as an example. How should an environmentalist feel about this new reality of $40, $50 oil?
You know, I am amazed, constantly amazed at the messages and whether on Twitter or emails that I get or even just talking to people and from an environmentalist point of view, of which I am one. And the main kind of emotion that I get is, wow, oil is way down. This is terrific, you know, because Exxon is just not making any money, you know, and all of those Shell going into the Arctic, you know, with a drill rig, you know, is going to lose billions because they just can't get it out of the ground for this price, and. You know, I try to dissuade them that you're really looking at the problem from a backwards point of view because of the reasons that you cite. There's absolutely no interest, at least from an economic standpoint, in further developing strong renewable sources when oil is $45 a barrel. There's just no need for it. You cannot develop a renewable source that is economically even closely competitive with a $45 a barrel price for oil. And if you are an environmentalist really concerned about turning off the oil spigots, forcefully turning off the oil spigots. You don't want a $45 price for oil. You want a $240 price for a barrel of oil, because when you get to a price like that, all of a sudden, every renewable alternative has economic merit, and you start to have real people, financial people, interested in developing those sources because they become more and more economically viable and more profitable. So from an environmental standpoint, I would like to see more of them understand the economics or try to understand the economics and at least get the story straight.
I try to give that woman everything in the world she needs. That's why she don't do nothing but lay up in her bed and read, you know, and she walks just like she got oil wells in her backyard. Sometime I think she do when we run. Yeah, but you ever hear that woman hooting, hollering, crying, talking about these times being hard?
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to energy expert Daniel Dicker. Dan's latest book is Shale Boom, Shale Bust, The Myth of Saudi America. Where do you think there is hope for an environmentalist when we're thinking that oil's not going to go to $240 a barrel anytime too soon? Where do you see the solutions?
Well, you know, for me, it's always been the same. It's been in a, what I believe is in a, not a peak oil based, but in a general cost based analysis of the oil industry, and recognizing not, of course, that we're poisoning the planet, because of course we're poisoning the planet, but try to get, you know, the general public to care about that as they're driving their kids to soccer practice. It's really hard. But what you can get them to understand is that the price for oil extraction and the days of easy oil extraction, despite these bumps in the road that we have, for example, that we've had for the last year and will continue to see probably for the next half year at least, if not another year, are just bumps in the road, and that the economics of oil, the way that I see them, are inevitably upwards. They have to be, because demand for energy of any kind, renewable or otherwise, continues to increase and shows no sign of stopping. And the supply of fossil fuels continues to get not more rare, although it does to a certain degree, but that's not really the point. It gets more expensive. The production, for example, in offshore drilling, there's been efficiency gains, but for the most part, easy wells are all but emptied, as they are here in the United States. And every new source of energy provides a greater technical challenges, deeper drilling, more difficult cementing practices, physics that you cannot believe, pumps that have to be to follow not only new regulations, but also new pressures, both air and sea pressures. And all of this adds to the cost of extraction. And that is inexorable. As the easy wells empty, every remaining well that you're forced to drill gets more expensive. And that's my hope.
And we're not even talking about the external costs of a potential spill in a fragile ecosystem like the Arctic, right?
That's another environmental challenge, but it really doesn't have to do with finances. And that's my hope as an environmentalist, as an oil guy who's also an environmentalist, is that that inexorable march of more expensive oil continues until it's economically impossible not to recognize renewables as the next obvious change in how we get our energy and how we power ourselves for the future.
I don't know if you followed the piece by Inside Climate News that came out in the last few weeks that was chronicling some of the early 80s research that ExxonMobil was engaged in with definitive proof that ExxonMobil knew before many of us knew that burning fossil fuels leads to higher CO2 levels, and that they, surprise, surprise, did nothing to change their behavior. Has there been any blowback in terms of ExxonMobil from this piece?
We as environmentalists, we stand around and we look upon the energy industry and the ExxonMobils and Chevrons of the world, and we can't help but scowl and tisk tisk, and to expect, you know, a company to be in some way responsible, environmentally responsible, when their financial health depends upon polluting the planet, is to mistake, you know, what we can expect. And I don't expect the tobacco companies to tell me definitively that smoking is going to kill me. I do not expect drug companies to tell me that, you know, a certain mixture or overdoing of drugs is going to harm me over the long haul, or even expect them to go out of their way to make sure that that's something that they're selling is safe for me to take for, you know, 5 years or a decade. And I certainly don't expect oil companies, as smart as they are, even recognizing obviously how burning fossil fuels has been detrimental to the environment, to all of a sudden turn around and say, hey, we're going to, you know, find another solution here, because the money isn't enough. The money's enough.
But the way the shareholder model is set up with these large oil companies, there's not enough incentive, you'd probably agree, for the management at an ExxonMobil to be able to look 20, 30 years into the future and make those investments with the idea of a $240 barrel pricing, as we saw them shed a lot of their renewable assets in their portfolios over the last decade.
Well, look at that. It's very interesting. In fact, you bring up a very good point. So they're agnostic when it comes to profits, and we know that. So the reason that they shed those renewable projects was for the same reason that they brought them on in the first place. In fact, that they saw a straight up move for oil and knew that economically speaking, they would have to develop other renewable sources in order to compete in the energy world of, you know, the future. And when they saw that oil prices could come down and make it uneconomic to continue to develop these things, they stopped pouring money into them. Again, another reason for environmentalists to cling to what I think is an inexorable increase in the cost of extraction of fossil fuels. You know, there was a CEO of one of the major natural gas companies or coal companies. I'm not sure if it was Peabody.
Well, maybe it was Duke Energy, right?
It was Duke. You're right. And he would come on all the shows and say, no, we're very much concerned about the emissions that our power plants are putting out. And we'd like to change that. And then, of course, you know, you'd get into a boardroom where people are deciding, you know, what kind of changes to make. And they all lower profitability and increase costs. And that CEO was eventually run out of town.
Same thing with John Brown at BP.
Exactly. It's exactly the same thing with John Brown at BP. So again, you're right. The model is about profits and not about civic responsibility. And as environmentalists, we shouldn't expect civic responsibility from oil companies. And we don't get it. So it all works out.
He's energy expert Daniel Dicker. His latest book is Shale Boom, Shale Bust, The Myth of Saudi America. Dan, thanks so much for joining me on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. Sway the future to the past.
past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Mandrill, Tower of Power, and The Grateful Dead. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.